Good afternoon, you. I hope your head isn't too sore today. I hope your head's okay. Welcome to Monday's Richie Allen Radio Show, live from Salford City, with me, the BBG.
It's the BBG, not the BBC. This is your Richie Allen Show, live from the magnificent city of Salford.
It's the Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
I'm delighted to welcome back to the programme today the wonderful Dr. Anne McCloskey. What an amazing woman. Irrepressible even is Anne. We first met Anne a couple of years ago. She talked about coming out of retirement in 2020 to help with the COVID effort, saw something was very wrong, spoke out about it, was attacked, was targeted, and was suspended, even though she had retired. She never took it lying down and has fought it all the way. We'll talk with Anne today about lots and lots of things. She will throw her hat back into the political ring soon. You might remember she was a member of AN2. She was a councillor for AN2 in Northern Ireland. She is going back into politics. We'll ask her why. You'll find her on Facebook, Dr. Anne for Derry. Dr. Anne with an E, 4, the number 4, Derry. Do check her out. Extended conversation. She will join me in around about 30 minutes' time. And you know by now, if you'd like to reach out to me during the programme, it's very simple. Leave a message via the website, or that's richieallen.co.uk. Do download the app. The app is very good. It's very functional. Any message you send me gets to me the very second you press send. The second. So it is. You have to laugh at Sputnik News in Russia, which has a great sense of humour, I think. I'm not endorsing it. I'm certainly not endorsing Russia or any leader, the Russian president or the leader of any country. Of course I don't. You know me by now. But fair play to Sputnik. They ran a story today saying that King Charles had died. King Charles. The third. But it seems that this is a gag, and it is in response to what Russia believes is fake news in Western media about the Russian election result. Vladimir Putin has won by a landslide of 87%. And of course, they say, the media in the West, is that he had no credible opposition, and that the Kremlin has a very tight control over Russia's political system, Russia's media and the elections. Crowds have been gathering today in Red Square, in Moscow, as we would say, Moscow, in the United States. Today, or this week, sees the 10th anniversary of Russia's annexation of Crimea. As I said, the EU, the UK, the US has called it a pseudo-election. You've got to laugh. The United States said the vote is obviously not free and not fair. Imagine the United States. Does anybody remember the election of 2000? Does anybody remember Catherine Harris and Jeb Bush, the brother of George W. Bush? Remember Jeb Bush, governor of Florida, brother of eventual president George W. Bush? Remember what they did? They paid a company called Database Technologies to disenfranchise black voters, to wipe their names off the electoral roll in Florida, so that when thousands of people turned up to vote in Florida in the 2000 presidential election, they were told to go home. Thousands wrongfully disenfranchised. And of course, George W. Bush won the state of Florida and therefore won the election. He didn't even really win the state of Florida. So you've got to have a good memory in this job, you know. It's funny when the United States accuses anybody of electoral fraud. Go and piss off, we say. Very important story, breaking, developing, not breaking, developing overnight in Gaza. Got to remember Gaza. You know, it's been going on since October 7th. The Israeli response to it, 31,500 people dead now, says the health ministry in Gaza. It's probably much more than that. Everybody accepts this, by the way. Israel says, we now control the Al-Shifa hospital in Gaza City. They launched an overnight raid. They say the hospital was being used by Hamas as a base. They've offered no evidence of this, of course. Hamas says this is nonsense. Nonsense, says Hamas, a fabricated narrative by the Israeli government. Let's hear Anita McVeigh on BBC News 24 this afternoon. Anita McVeigh.
And a UN-backed report says around half of Gaza's population, some 1.1 million people, are already experiencing catastrophic hunger. The Integrated Food Security Phase Classification Report also says famine is imminent in northern Gaza and is projected between now and May. Around 300,000 people are still in the north, trapped by fighting and struggling for food. And in the last half an hour, the UN's Secretary General said the report was an appalling indictment of conditions on the ground for civilians.
And she spoke with Human Rights Watch Programme Director, a woman called Sara Bashi, for more on the situation faced by Palestinians in Gaza today.
Well, the famine-like conditions are man-made. From the very beginning, the Israeli military stopped the delivery of food, fuel, electricity, and other life-saving goods, and later allowed only a trickle of aid in through the land crossings, very little of it reaching the north. The Israeli military has delayed or denied humanitarian missions to the north, actually bombed trucks bringing in aid, and killed a record number, well over 100 UN aid workers for UNRWA.
Well, the Israeli military, of course, says that it has provided corridors for aid to reach where it's needed.
More than half of the requests for missions to the north from the south to bring the aid in have been delayed or denied, and the Israeli military has refused to allow the aid in through plentiful truck routes that would allow it to go directly to the north. When you bring it in from the south, it is very difficult to bring it all the way to the north because we have waited until people are desperate. Hungry people are looting the trucks because there's not enough. There is a choice. The Israeli military can open up adequate land routes, fulfill its obligation to secure those convoys and protect people so that they can actually have enough to eat. This doesn't have to be this way.
Yeah, I mean, since October 7th, we've seen what's happened. Israel said to the Palestinian people, we want you to move in this direction. We want you to move to point B. They moved to point B. As they moved, they were bombed, they were massacred. When those who did make it to point B were bombed and massacred and then told to move to point C and so on until they reached Rafah. This is the truth, not conjecture. And after they bombed them and kept moving them around, they continued to destroy the homes and all of the infrastructure that they had left behind at each juncture. That's what the Israelis have done. It's genocide. They're starving them and killing them. And that's the plan. It's as simple as that. No matter what they say, no matter what the Israeli Defense Ministry or the Israeli Prime Minister or the Israeli President says, it's genocide. It's as simple as that. Kemi Badenoch, the business secretary, a black woman, told LBC presenter Nick Jabba the Hutt Ferrari this morning that she's tired of talking about racism as the fallout from the Frank Hester saga continues. Now, Frank Hester is the businessman who has donated around £15 million to the Conservative Party in the last 12 months. He was overheard or recorded at a meeting about 5 years ago saying that Diane Abbott, the Labour, formerly the Labour MP, the black woman herself, she's suspended by the Labour Party. He was heard saying, allegedly, that she made him want to hate all black women and that she should be shot. That was several years ago. The Tories have been urged to give back the money he has donated to the party. This has just rumbled on and on and on. The business secretary, Kemi Badenoch, again, importantly, a black woman, says, I'm tired of it. And she tells Nick Ferrari why. It's interesting.
The point I'm making is that when people apologise, they should be forgiven. And these comments were in no way reflective of the work that he has been doing, why we have taken his money. We need to get to a point where we stop chasing people around and looking everywhere for the racism. The person he's made the comments about, if I may finish, please, the person he's made the comments about has, of course, been suspended from the party for the same thing. We are ending up in a spiral where everybody is accusing and counter-accusing around racism. I think we need to move away from these things and actually focus on what matters to people.
Hear, hear. But doesn't he at least have to accept the comments were racist? the donor himself.
I think he's apologized for them.
But we've answered these questions.
I haven't spoken to him, but we've been talking about this for well over a week now. This is trivia, Nick. I'm sorry, but I really do believe it is.
She said it is trivia. She made some interesting points there about a spiral of racist accusations or accusations of racism and then counter accusations of racism by those who had been accused of racist. In the opinion of this Baldy Gammon, they can't really go after each other on matters of policy, can they? Because they don't have differences between them when it comes to policy. So all they're left with is who's the biggest racist. Anyway, listening to Kemi Badenoch say that it is a trivial matter, listening in the green room of LBC in Leicester Square was James O'Brien. Hilarity ensues. Listen to this.
It's the polar opposite of trivial. It's desperately important.
Desperately important now. Frank Hester, 5 years ago. She makes me want to hate black women. She should be shot.
It's an issue of national importance.
National importance.
Because the party of government is being bankrolled by a man who has said unthinkably awful things.
Unthinkably.
And
I bet you he said worse.
They are excusing him. They are letting him off the hook. I can't change that. You can't change that.
I don't care.
We can't demand justice until justice is delivered.
Justice? What sort of justice for a bloke who's in a meeting with a group of people and doesn't particularly like Diane Abbott and references her gender and her race? Again, I don't think it's particularly, you know, appealing. It's not appetizing. It's not nice. But what justice? I mean, who needs justice? Where's the crime?
But what we can do is refuse to accept any attempt to trivialize it or undermine it, to refuse to let it just become yesterday's news, to become fish and chip newspaper. It is a matter of epic importance.
It's a matter of epic importance. We can't allow it to be discarded into the waste paper bin. Yesterday's news. We can't. We got to keep going on and on and on and on about it. Why, James?
That the man bankrolling the party of government, the man essentially writing the checks upon which they will fight the next general election,
right,
is being allowed a free pass on the most vile and explicit of racism.
Really?
Upon wishing a black politician, a black woman, dead.
He didn't wish her dead. We've all said this a million times. We've all said this a million times about people we don't like. He should be shot. She should be shot. Did you hear that dickhead on Question Time last night? He should be shot. We've all said it. Nobody means it. I don't expect to get up the following morning and to find out that the guy was actually shot by somebody. You know, this is hysterical claptrap, isn't it?
On wanting her to be shot.
No, he didn't want her to be shot. You couldn't, that wouldn't stand up in any court of law anyway.
This is an act of almost unbelievable.
I know you think this can't get any worse, right? But it does. It gets worse. I know you don't believe it.
This is an act of almost unbelievable indecency in the in the context of public discourse. And that's why I can't get my head around why Kemi Badenoch has A, brought it back to the top of the agenda today.
But she didn't. She didn't bring it back. She was asked by Nick Ferrari, and she's tired of hearing it, this black woman. You know, I'm no fan of Kemi Badenoch or the Tories or any of them, but this black woman has said, I'm sick to death of hearing about it. You know what? I wasn't injured by it. You know, nothing happened to me when some bloke in a boardroom 5 years ago said he'd like a black woman to be shot, which he didn't really mean. I'm just tired of hearing about it. It's trivial bullshit when you look at some of the things going on in the world today.
And B, even framed the thoughts that she articulated to Nick Ferrari by essentially siding with the £15 million donor.
No, she didn't. She didn't side with the £15 million donor. She said the comments were racist. She's clearly said it. She said it several times. But that she just wants to move on from it because it doesn't really matter.
Against, to use his phrase, against all black women.
If I was a private investigator and I had a bit of time on my hands, if I was a well-paid and comfortably off private investigator, I'd spend a week or two on James O'Brien. It has been my experience. I've been a journalist now for nearly 30 years. It has been my experience that the most Oh, the most perfect, at least by their own claim, the most holier than thou people, like O'Brien, usually they don't have a skeleton or two in their closets. They have graveyards. I would love somebody, if you're listening to this programme, not because I hate James O'Brien, I certainly do not, I don't hate anybody, but I can't stand preachy bullshitters like him, virtue signalers. I can't stand them. We are all fallible, we have all made mistakes. I have done and said things over the years I am not proud of, like everybody else. You do your best, right? You learn, you move on. I'd love somebody to turn that fucker upside down. Shake him a bit and see what falls out. I bet you it will be epic. Nobody is that nice. Nobody is that perfect. Nobody is that, you know, every man or every woman type person. We've all said and done things over the years we're not proud of. I've been explicit about those things on this programme. Shocked people over the years by saying, yeah, when I was a younger guy, I said this. Or I said that. I can't believe you admitted that, Richie. Well, I did, you see. Because I did. But anyway, let's leave him alone and let's talk about GB News, because this is also interesting. But on the racism, this idea of accusation and counter-accusation, I really do believe you can't separate these morons on policy, these parties. They're the same on everything. We've learned this particularly in the last 3 to 4 years. So now it's about who's the least racist. Will they really fight the forthcoming election on that? Possibly. Right, look, Ofcom, GB News, Ofcom, broadcast regulator here in the UK, the media regulator. GB News has been warned about its use of politicians as presenters after Ofcom ruled 5 episodes of programmes hosted by serving Tory MPs broke its rules. Ofcom said shows hosted by Jacob Rees-Mogg, Esther McVeigh and Philip Davies broke rules stating politicians should not usually front news coverage. This is, it's outlandish for us to be even talking about this. And you will please acknowledge me, please give me this much. I've been banging on about this for several years when we first began to see politicians present programmes for LBC Radio. This is an outrage against public decency, is that a politician would be given a news programme. Anyway, it's ridiculous, isn't it? As I've said before, if it actually wasn't happening, you'd never believe it, would you? If somebody said to you, this will happen one day, you'd say, well, no, it won't. Well, it is happening. Anyway, okay. I've made the point over the years, you know, the news media, you know, outed itself as being what it actually is, a propagandist for the agenda, never holding power or real power to account, and having outed itself as not being there to serve the interests of the people, it decided, well, we can go for broke now because we're not asking questions of politicians and we haven't done for 2 or 3 decades. Let's cut out the middleman. Let's cut out the middleman. Let's get rid of news presenters and just give these bastards their own television and radio shows, which is exactly what has happened. On the GB News debacle, here's the BBC News media editor, a guy called David Sillitoe. Here he is on this story.
Okay, here are the rules. If you're an acting serving politician, yes, you can present a programme on British television. You can also present a current affairs programme. But you can't do news, and that's what this is all about. Now, GB News says that these programmes were essentially, well, general programmes, discussion programmes, they were not the news. So there was this analysis of 5 of them, this is over May and June of last year, and on 5 occasions, GB News is said to have essentially, well, these politicians, Jacob Rees-Mogg, Esther McVeigh and Philip Davies, crossed the line into doing news. Well, what does that actually mean? Let's look at Jacob Rees-Mogg. There were instances where they said there was a breaking news, for instance, about Donald Trump and a civil legal action. He was there going to reports that were breaking at the time there. Essentially, they said he was acting as a news presenter. Also, comments about King Charles and his alleged political views. So there were these moments where they said they crossed from commentary and debate into actually presenting the news. Now, GB News says it was entirely impartial. They believe it was entirely impartial, and it was absolutely right, and they believe that there is huge uncertainty in these rules about what is allowed and what's not allowed. And they believe that they didn't break the rules. The phrase they used today in their response was chilling in what impact it would have on media diversity. Now, of course, no fine or sanction for GB News, because Ofcom says that this is essentially happened a year ago over a specific period of time, and they've had no serious complaints since then. Of course, these programmes are not in the air at the moment. So no sanctions, but if it happens again, they'll be fined.
Yeah, he's right. They are permitted by the regulatory body to put politicians on air, give them their own programme, so long as it isn't a news programme. So long as it is an interview programme or a programme where it is specifically commentary, which is pretty much what the news is today anyway. But it is an outrage. That law ought to be changed. Politicians should not be allowed to present programmes on television, full stop, while they are serving as members of Parliament. It's ludicrous, isn't it? It's absolutely ludicrous. Good evening to Kay, who says, the likes of O'Brien, Hartley, Brewer, Rees Mogg, I have no idea, she says. No one is listening to them anymore. I think they have some listeners, Kay. But she says, everyone I talk to, from the local hairdresser to the butcher to the staff at the supermarket checkouts, nobody is listening to them, says Kay. Look, it is true that they are, in some cases, hemorrhaging listeners. O'Brien's been hemorrhaging listeners, lost 500,000 listeners last year. Funnily enough, on this, this afternoon, I spent a bit of time comparing streaming data for the Richie Allen Show from this time last year to today, and we're up about 6%, just under 6%, 5.89% or something like that. More listeners listening live now than were listening live in March of 2023. So that's a nice thing, isn't it? Makes it all worthwhile, I suppose. I haven't yet looked at the podcast listening numbers for the same period to see if there's any difference, if maybe there's a tiny drop off in the podcast numbers, but I don't think so, because it's doing well in the national charts. So it is, so that's a nice thing. Thank you for listening to the programme and for supporting it, and more importantly, hi to Gordon, who says, Richie, if Frank Hester had said he wished James O'Brien had been shot, he could have saved himself £15 million. Gordon, thank you for that. Great. Peter says, hello Peter, I'll spend a week or two on James O'Brien, just be careful how you say that, Richie. He says, I don't remember saying that at all. 23 minutes it is past the hour. It is Monday's programme. Dr. Anne McCloskey will be on the programme shortly. I think her head is okay. I asked her a little bit earlier on, so how's your head after the St. Patrick's Day festivities yesterday? You can leave a message for the programme at my website, richieallen.co.uk. Otherwise, download the app, send a message instantly. As you click send, it gets to me immediately. Okay, yes, and sometimes at the beginning of the programme, the website, richieallen.co.uk, is a smidgen slow. And that's a traffic issue. That's all that is. People piling on to listen. That's why I'm encouraging and pushing the app over and over and over, pushing the app. All right. Here's an interesting bit of audio, which kind of sums up the way things are going, at least in terms of not just the mainstream media, but even the offshoot of mainstream media, which would be, you know, moderately to reasonably well-known people doing their own podcast. Now, John Ronson is an interesting character. I first came across John Ronson, I would say, about 25 years ago. He made a documentary for Channel 4, but he also wrote a book. He wrote a book called Them, adventures with extremists about 25 years ago, maybe a little bit longer, but I think about 25 years ago. And he featured David Icke in this, them adventures with extremists. And I was, you know, beginning to take an interest in David and his books, so I watched it with great interest. So John Ronson has written books. He also wrote The Men Who Stare at Goats, right? He's making a podcast for the BBC about culture wars. And in a recent episode of this, you can hear John Ronson speaking with a colleague of his whose name escapes me, but it doesn't matter. And they're speaking about Graham Linehan, the author and comedy screenwriter, responsible for many things, but Father Ted, of course, being the most famous and the most successful. Here they are talking about Graham Linehan, and this kind of makes the point that, well, maybe I've made it too many times, but have a listen. Listen to this. They're talking about Linehan.
So they came to you with that idea?
Yeah, the BBC said, do you want to do something about the culture wars?
So Ronson is explaining how he came to be making his current podcast about culture wars, right? And he invokes Linehan's story.
And I was kind of obsessed with a mutual friend of ours.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And his kind of collapse.
Yeah.
A mutual friend of ours is a comedy writer who... a brilliant comedy writer, but he got too embroiled in the culture wars and it completely took over his life to the extent that he lost all of his work and his family. And I was watching this happening and just really trying to figure out what were the mechanics of this.
Right.
Because it wasn't just him. This was happening all over the place.
Yeah.
People were toppling. And so when the BBC came to me with that idea, I probably wouldn't have agreed to do it if I wasn't already kind of obsessed with that aspect of it. Like, what is it about the culture wars that are causing people to really, you know, plummet down rabbit holes that they then can't escape from?
Wow, that's bad enough, right? Listen, they don't have the courage to name Graham Linehan, even though it's obvious who they're talking about, speaking about. Listen to the comeback from Ronson's pal. And this is the thing that kills me about the media.
Well, mentioning our mutual friend...
Graham Linehan.
At the time, I remember he was saying to me, I'd love to come on the podcast and chat with you about this issue that he was so embroiled in.
Right. So presumably you said, brilliant, Graham. I'm not entirely in agreement with you, but I'd love to have you on, Graham. Yeah. Right. Did he? Is that what he said?
But I couldn't see a way for it to be productive, for it to be useful. I thought this conversation is totally zero sum.
Jesus, Mary and Holy Saint Joseph. God save us.
There's no enlightenment and understanding coming out of it that I can see.
Oh my God. Linehan has become more famous for this activism around protecting children from drugs and puberty delaying medicines and stuff. And he's been absolutely destroyed for it. You know, his career has been ruined. Nobody deserves what has happened to Graham Linehan. And rather than say, I tell you what, pal, yeah, look, we're old mates, you know, from the comedy days. So I'll bring you on and I'll challenge you, but we'll get your side of the story. This dickhead says this, and this is all pervasive, even in the independent media.
But I couldn't see a way for it to be productive, for it to be useful. I thought this conversation is totally zero sum.
Journalism is dead, isn't it? It's completely gone. Dare I say it? Not here it isn't. You do your best, you know. I just couldn't believe myself hearing this. I couldn't believe it. You know, I was given his email address, I invited him on to this programme, Graham Linehan. He didn't want to come on, fair enough. But that's outrageous. It's 28 and a half minutes past the hour. Monday's Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live from the heart of Salford City. I feel like a bit of Phil Collins. Like a bit of Phil Collins sometimes. The Richie Allen Show, broadcasting on multiple platforms around the world. And every podcast provider will give you the podcast if you don't catch the live radio show. Back in a moment with Dr. Anne McCluskey. She's brilliant. You don't want to miss her. Keep sending the messages in. I'll be reading them out as we go along then. Music from Phil Collins. That's Two Hearts on the Richie Allen Show. 29 minutes it is to the hour of 5 o'clock. Monday's programme, it is March 18th, the day after St. Paddy's Day. Thank you for all the messages about the game. Yes, I was at Old Trafford yesterday for the game. And the reason I can speak is because I'm quite used to attending football matches and rugby league matches and the odd hurling match here in Manchester as well. I've become used to biting my tongue and not screaming, however exciting things get. It's been a long time since my guest was on the programme, and I'm very excited to welcome her back. I really am. I've been in touch. We've been in touch, I should say, more than once since. Look, when we first met her, she came on to talk about how back in 2020, she came out of retirement to help with the COVID effort. She did a really decent and noble thing, but saw something was very wrong with it, with the narrative, and spoke out about it. And then, despite the fact that she'd been retired, she was suspended from practicing medicine. Right now, she never took that lying down. And that battle has gone on ever since we last spoke, and we can talk about this in a moment, even though she has no intentions of ever working for the NHS again. I reached out to her over the weekend because I noticed that she's planning on throwing her hat, if you can say that, back into the political ring. She was once a councillor for AN2, you know all about the AN2 party. She left that party because they censored her. Amazingly censored her when she spoke out about masks and about COVID interventions. It's a real pleasure to welcome to this programme, the one and only Dr. Anne McCloskey. Hello, Anne. Welcome back. How are you?
Hi, Rich. I'm great altogether. It's lovely to be back. Yeah, it's been a while, but we can catch up.
Yeah, we can. With your blessing, I think we said we have an hour. We can have a few more minutes than that. And there's a lot I want to get into, you know, the impact of some of the measures on children, the psychological issues with kids. We talk about gender wars. There's lots to talk about because I know that you are across a lot of these issues that we talk about on this program, and it's genuinely lovely to have you back on the show. How's the head? I'm sure you had a couple of G&Ts or a whiskey or two or a pint of the black stuff yesterday, but you sound okay though.
I'm grand, yeah. I'm off the booze for Lent. Not mind you that I have much opportunity to be socialising. I'm too bloody busy.
You're too busy.
But I had a few scoops yesterday, just quietly, and yeah. Let me tell you. I watched the St. Patrick's Day parade. Went to the Latin Mass. It was grand.
You went to the Latin Mass. Did you? Fair play to you.
I can't be dealing with the leprechauns. It's grand. You know, I would have went with my wee granddaughter that she was in it last year. But no, the whole thing is just, and I think it's once you see, you know, the whole thing is just demeaning, the meaning of you know, our patron saint's day, you know, and it's just, you know, leprechauns and mushrooms and, you know, just cardology. Yeah.
Yeah, it's not a Christian reflection, is it, at all anymore? It certainly isn't. It was when I was younger. There's
absolutely
no doubt about that.
Yeah, you know, and I'm all for, I mean, about a paddywhackery, it doesn't bother me. You know, it's, and the leprechauns are grand, but whenever there's nothing else, you know, absolutely nothing else, there's just, it's you know, complete rejection of anything that would elevate your spirit a wee bit, you know, and I don't know, maybe I'm sounding like a cranky old woman, but anyway.
You're not sounding like a cranky old woman at all.
Yeah.
I can tell you this, Anne, if I go to the comments in 10 minutes from now, that will have resonated with a lot of our listeners, and they will be saying, I have no doubt in my mind, they'll agree with you. And look, we're a free speech platform, so I'll read them all out, whether they agree with you or not. But the majority of them, and I'm not a practicing Christian, you know, I'm a lapsed Catholic, but I wholeheartedly agree with what you've said, because I see it. I see it here. I've seen it back home as well. Can I ask you this, right? Because it's been so long, when you find yourself looking back at the last 3.5 years, as I'm sure you do sometimes when you reflect on it, how does it make you feel? What comes to mind when somebody says to you, Anne, could you describe for me how you navigated the last 3.5 years, 4 years now we're coming up on? How would you answer them?
Well, I suppose from my teens, I've been a political animal, you know, and was involved in, you know, the campaigns in Northern Ireland and the north of Ireland over the years, and you know, was involved in the pro-life movement, was involved. You know, I've always been, if something's wrong, you know, it rankles with me. And I would you know, just maybe I'm a bit of a mouth, but I have to. I'd be writing letters to the papers. And I mean, right from the start of the corona baloney, you know, I was emailing the chief medical officer and emailing, you know, the local politicians. And, you know, it just, and I know, I mean, it's been, I have four children and I worked as a GP in the olden days. Whenever you did one night and four on call, one weekend and four on call, you'd have been out maybe breastfeeding a baby and out in a house call at 4 a.m, you know, all of that. I've never been busier than I have this last 3 years, particularly the last since I really took on the General Medical Council in the courts. And it has been just in, really and truly, it's a 12-hour day, and I'm not joking. And I mean, we know that these people aren't ready to let us have any victories yet. I mean, they're just doubling down in the narrative. We've won in the court. We've won the argument. We've won it in every way. But these are historical times. And what can you do? As I said, I was talking to Sam Bailey there recently. He just said, this is the battle of our lives. This is the battle for our civilization. And unfortunately, not very many people yet seem to know that. It's kind of, you know, but for me, you know, every day I'm empowered. I'm strong. Thanks be to God. I have wonderful people around me. I have, you know, just people that are helping and supporting me. I forgot to see because I'm so flaky. I forgot. I have to, because of the desperate times that we live in. I was looking at the UK column news where a wee German girl was hauled out of her chemistry class at school for saying that she loved her motherland, her country, you know. So anyway, I have to do this wee couple of sentence disclaimer. So what I'm going to talk about are my personal experiences, observations, opinions. It's for educational purposes only. And although I'm a doctor, I ain't your doctor. I'm not providing medical or legal advice to the public, and those who need medical diagnosis or treatment or legal advice should go and find a good professional and ask people to use their due diligence. And it's not my intention to harass, to intimidate, offend, defame, conspire, blackmail, coerce, cause anxiety, alarm or distress. The information presented here is done so with peaceful and honourable intentions. As always, do your own research and use your own discernment. I hate doing this, Richie.
Yeah, who's asked you to do this, Anne? Who's asked you to read that out?
Somebody who's given me a lot of help in the legal field. I mean, the thing is that we now know, particularly on this benighted island, that the hate speech, the censorship, but what happened to that wee German girl, you know, taken from her chemistry class.
Well, I tell you what, Anne, if that is true, I'm going to go and look for that myself. Not that I totally believe you, of course. That is incredibly worrying.
Well, now they don't, their sources are usually rock solid, yeah.
That's a horrendous, I mean, if that's true, that is
absolutely. It's coming here, Richie. Yeah. It is coming here. There's absolutely no doubt. You know, they want to close down platforms like yourself. Free speech is under threat like it has never been. This is Orwell, you know, called it.
Well, you're right. I mean, if you look at the UK government's attempt to redefine or broaden the definition of extremism, and you don't have to be a genius to see that they really want to give themselves the power to label whatever they feel like as extremism so that they can shut those people down, right? And it's going on in our country, in Ireland too. In fact, it's planned to be worse in Ireland, isn't it? Because if you, Dr. Anne McCluskey, if you decide that you want to look into something, you know, you might want to read something by somebody who said something a bit bizarre and you want to check it out, you could be, just for holding the material on your phone or on your computer, you could be considered subversive or dangerous, and you might find yourself under arrest. That's if the Irish government gets its way.
Yeah, in the 26 counties, certainly that is the current position, where possession of material, even without intent to use it or to distribute it, is of itself an offence. And I think I can't remember, it's astronomical fines, €5,000 or something like that, and the possibility of imprisonment. This is, you know, I laugh because they talk about the liberal democracies and the rules-based international order. This is nuts. Like, this is
North Korea, isn't it? I mean, it's funny that they mention isn't it hilarious today that the Western what they call democracies, but the news agencies of the West are talking about banana republics in Russia and autocrats and authoritarian regimes. And when you look at what they're doing to their own people in these countries, they're not in any position to be throwing stones at Putin's glasshouse, are they, Anne? Absolutely. When you look at it.
So that's why, as I say, I hate formal, you know, the sort of disclaimers and stuff like that. But I do think that certainly people in the public eye need to start thinking about, you know, for example, there, you know, it's if you attend, if somebody takes offence, you know the way it is now, these people have... The young ones coming out have degrees in victimology, and you know, if you say something that somebody doesn't like, they can say that you have hurt them, you've caused them harm, and the whole thing. The next thing you know, you're in court. It happened to a friend of mine, $30,000 fine, for, you know, essentially a tweet that she didn't even make. So yeah, it's complicated, and the world is getting harder and harder to navigate that kind of public space.
Before we come back,
the issue is that the BBC and Ofcom are going to be the only arbiters of you know what is allowed to be said.
Yeah, and you're right to mention the BBC setting up its BBC Verify organisation, which is nonsense. Yeah, I want to come back.
Marianna Spring lied on her CV.
I know, isn't it ironic? Isn't it? Made out that she worked closely with somebody in her CV, and it turned out that she didn't. I mean. Listen,
all you need to know about the truth guru.
Well, it's funny, Anne, isn't it? I mean, I'm going to be honest. As a younger man, I would have exaggerated a little bit on my CV, but at the same time, I wasn't at the same time preaching to people about, you know, telling the truth and being like 100% Snow White. And before we come back to the targeting of you, I don't want to dwell too much on that because you're probably sick of it. I want to get your opinion on a wide range of things. On the free speech thing, we might find an area of disagreement here, which will be good fun for us and for the listeners. You might disagree with me here. Look, I went to the game yesterday and I came back from it, and I read last night that several United fans had been arrested for tragedy chanting. Now, before anybody starts jumping on me, as a younger man, I went out of my way, and I don't want any credit for this, but I went out of my way to interview the family members of people who died at Hillsborough. And I completely, as a journalist, supported the Hillsborough families and their fight for justice because of the massive cover-up by the British state and by the police and blaming the victims of Hillsborough. So I was always on, and always will be, on the side of the families. And I am a bit pissed off when people say things. I'll be honest with you, Anne, I was behind a goal in the East Stand yesterday, and there were a few guys around me shouting murderers and the sun was right and all that nonsense, right? And I don't like it, and I bite my tongue and I just watch the game. But isn't it shocking that you could arrest somebody and charge them for essentially saying things that might hurt somebody else's feelings? I'm not saying that the morons shouting anti-Hillsborough family stuff don't deserve a slap around the mouth or a fat lip, but to be arresting the man, it's an absolute slippery slope that I just can't get my head around it. I wouldn't see a Liverpool fan arrested for making comments about the Munich air disaster or singing about anybody who died in tragic circumstances. I just think it's kind of indicative of where we are and what you were talking about. I find it very dangerous. What do you think?
Well, you can't advocate free speech only for people you agree with.
Yeah.
Free speech is free speech. You have the right to be offended, and you have the right to offend if that's what's required. You know, so yeah, it's for me, it's very simple. You know, yeah. Nothing, you know, unless you cause actual harm or are inciting to cause harm to somebody, then you can say whatever the hell you like. And certainly, I mean, in my position, I mean, I sometimes read the comments that people put up on social media about me. I just laugh, because what, you know, what would be the point? What would be the point of you know, picking over it and getting annoyed? You know, they're obviously, I'm right in everything I say, Richie, and they're wrong.
Absolutely, Anne. And that's the attitude to adopt if I were you. But look, you're a generation. And there's a little bit of difference in our age, but I'm from the same generation as you. The things said about me by people I don't know or who I am not invested in, it's like water off a duck's back. I couldn't care less what they say. Now, the people I love and the people who mean something to me, if they criticise me, it might sting. And I might have to sit down and I might have to listen to it. But not somebody who I don't have any time for, or even who I don't know. You're listening to Dr. Anne McCloskey. The General Medical Council, the establishment, went after this lady for saying something which a lot of people were thinking back in 2020 and 2021. And that was, why would you want to give this untested medical experiment to children? And they've come down on her, even though she'd retired, even though she hadn't planned on practicing medicine for the NHS again. Why do you think they came after you so hard, Anne? As much as anybody, they properly came after you. Why?
It's very simple. I have been posting videos since early 2020. I spoke in the Guildhall Square and at the first kind of public event. There was about 30 or 40 people, maybe 50 people in the crowd.
And I'm really sorry to do this. Oh, it's gone now. There was a real buzzy noise on the line there for a moment, a horrible noise. It's gone now. I could barely hear you, but it's gone. Thank God for that. Sorry for interrupting. You were saying...
I'm just saying, I had started, I saw this, what was happening pretty early on, and I made I spoke at a public rally. Someone asked me, would I say a few words? And I think I spoke for about 10 or 12 minutes and just called out the whole thing. And there was 30 or 40 people in the crowd, but David Icke got got his hands on it, and it got a million views because right. I think I was the first medical doctor to actually, at this stage there were no jabba dabbas about, but I was saying clearly it looks like this is a pretext to get some sort of pharmaceutical into the arms of the 7.8 billion souls who inhabit the earth. And a lot of it was speculative. I wasn't even sure if what I was saying was accurate, and I was sort of sharing that. So after that, all over that winter and spring, I was making videos in my back sitting room and in the front room, talking about PCR tests, talking about the casedemic, talking about the nonsense that was asymptomatic transmission. And it was all very data focused and driven by papers I'd read. But after the rollout of the bioweapons, so in August, the night of the 21st of August was a Saturday night, and I had done a late shift the night before and an early morning shift in Western Urgent Care. There was very little medical cover. The doctors were all busy doing other things, and I'll leave your listeners to speculate as to what they may have been doing. But that was the big jab weekend when they were using these unlicensed, unapproved, unindemnified medical experimental genetic therapies on children and young people. And I was distraught about it. And I saw over that weekend a few people who certainly, again, the old trope causation isn't, but it was obvious that what the things that happened then were things that I had never seen in for example, a young woman with a clot in her subclavian vein, an upper arm unprovoked clot. In 40 years of medical practice, I'd never seen her hair tell of anything like that. And she was told that whatever it was, it had nothing to do with the injection that she'd received 3 or 4 days previously. So I knew, I'd been watching for months the harms that these things were doing. I'd written to everybody I could think of, including the chief medical officer, all the Department of Health, all the General Medical Council, the my medical insurance people, the British Medical Association. There was a list of people that I'd written to about the problems in the nursing homes where the mortality rates after the rollout had gone through the roof.
Yeah.
And also then about the harms and asking about the fact that these were unlicensed, pointing this out.
And can I just stop you there? Is there something going on? Is there some building or something going on there? Or some drilling or something? Because we're getting a real buzzing sound. Is there not? Do you know what I'm going to try and do?
It's perfect at this end.
Is it? Yeah. No, I'm getting it from your feet. Do you mind if I very quickly disconnect and reconnect? It'll take me about 5 seconds, if you don't mind. Yeah, it might clear the line there.
Okay, does that sound any better now?
A million times better. And there's no buzzing. I reckon it was the spooks. I reckon it was the spooks at MI5, I reckon. I say this with a big grin on my face, but you never know, do you? But that does sound considerably better. Thank God for that. So we cut you off in your prime. We were talking about what you'd been doing, your understanding that the jabs had begun to cause harm. You'd seen it in clots in girls, things that had never happened before, and you knew that there had been a big problem in care homes shortly after the rollout of jabs when people were dying, and you knew this and you were talking about this, and that's where we left you.
So on the night of Saturday the 21st, about tea time, I think, I'd been mulling it over all day, and I knew the minute I started talking about my experiences and seeing harms done to people, that it was going to, the proverbial was going to hit the fan. And I just said, well, look, I have to do it anyway. So I made a video in the back sitting room talking about what I'd seen that weekend. And that would have been about 5 o'clock tea time, and thought no more of it. And what happened was at 11:15 that night, Dr. Sir Michael McBride, our chief medical officer, wrote an email to the woman who is in charge of GP, the what's called the performers list, a doctor called Dr. Margaret O'Brien. So he emailed her at 11:15 at night and said, and copied into that the two deputy chief medical officers and the head of the General Medical Council in Northern Ireland, copied these into this email. It says, "Dear Margaret, is this doctor on the performers list? I have significant, I can't remember the exact word, and significant and serious concerns about the disinformation that she has been spreading, and therefore her placement on the performers list. I would like that reviewed." In other words, what we had was the chief medical officer speaking to his subordinate and essentially giving her an order. Now, there had been people trying to get me silenced with writing to the General Medical Council and that for months. And I through a Freedom of Information and a subject access request, I have a box full of letters written by people to the General Medical Council. The General Medical Council saying, unless she has caused harm to an individual patient, there is no case to answer. She's entitled to say what she's saying. It seems to be data-driven. There's nothing, there's no fitness to practice issues here. But the moment that Professor Sir Michael, I'm not sure what order all these accolades come in, but Michael McBride, our chief medical officer, and the reason was, and again, I didn't know this when I made that video, was on the 20th of August, the day of the big jab weekend, he had signed off on a protocol for the unlicensed Pfizer-BioNTech BN2162B2 to be used in these leisure centres and in football fields and in GAA grounds for young people. And he then, here was me calling it out. And the video was shared widely because, you know, at that time, people were beginning to see in their own families and in their own lives what was happening. And so, yeah, after that, I went in to do a shift on Monday, the Monday afternoon after the Saturday, at 6 o'clock. The media knew I had been suspended before I did. I went into the shift at 6 o'clock and was told that I was no longer registered. And so the Dr. O'Brien certainly was very assiduous in carrying out her duties to have me silenced. And then, as I say, the General Medical Council, what they do is they don't look at evidence for the first 18 months. And I mean, this is absolutely in contravention of people's basic rights. You cannot, I mean, the Magna Carta and the Bill of Rights and all of these things, you cannot have forfeiture without a trial. You know, they can't take away your income and your reputation and your good name and your family peace and harmony and all of that without producing evidence. But they do, and they have been doing this for years. This is, it's in their book. So they review the thing every 3 months, and you go and tell them, you know, I still, what I'm saying is true and I can prove it. And they say, yeah. And they listen very attentively, and then they do what they were going to do anyway, which is extend your suspension. But what happens after 18 months is the General Medical Council don't have the authority to suspend you for longer without going to the High Court to seek an extension. So, and again, the legal people, Rich, you wouldn't believe it. This, you know, all of the solicitors working for the medical insurance companies, everybody, the GMC, the Department of Health, the government, it's seamless. That, you know, that they're all, everybody gets paid and nothing changes. That's what they want. So whenever I said I was going to challenge the General Medical Council in the High Court, the lawyers all freaked and said, no, you can't do that. What you do is you let them do the extension and then have a judicial review. Nobody has won these cases. I mean, I'm in touch with the doctors in England, poor Muhammad Adil and people like that, that are fighting in the courts and paying tens of thousands in legal fees. And as I say, they're laughing all the way to the bank. The whole thing, that whole medical insurance registration thing, is a complete dog and pony show.
It's a terrible thing to hear, really. I find it very difficult to hear this because, you know, my understanding of law is that at least in litigation or at least in cases in a case of a tribunal, so one party makes an allegation against somebody else. In this case, they made an allegation about you. You know, I'm naive. You know, I'm not now, but I was at the beginning of all this. I thought, well, they've got to very quickly produce some hard evidence against you and then you get to refute it and there's a quick decision. Learning that this isn't the case and that they can basically mess around and screw around for years if they want while you're in limbo and Muhammad Adil and others, it's a horrible thing to hear that. There's nothing just about that. That's not right. That's not fair. No. That's not humane, is it? It's terrible.
No. It's shocking. And as Dr. Adil or Mr. Adil, the surgeon, has pointed out, you know, there are cases where you have doctors who are, you know, having sexual relations on the NHS premises with patients and that, and they're getting slapped on the wrist. But it is this thing about, I mean, at the first tribunal where the General Medical Council suspended me, that was in September, I think. I had produced a 48-page, fully referenced, I mean, really comprehensive debunking of the whole COVID narrative and the theoretical, you know, molecular biology and the theoretical problems that were going to be with these mRNA technologies, which had never been used in humans before. They'd never even got to clinical trials before because they were known to be toxic and harmful. And I'd look back to papers that were written 10, 15 years previously. And I had people like Dolores Cahill, who was working with me, you know, and helping me to understand that what these were. So this 48-page document, the lawyers who were supposed to be representing me didn't even submit that to the tribunal. And what happened was a barrister in England, whom I had met in a Zoom call a couple of hours before the tribunal started, paraphrased bits and pieces of it. And they kept talking about, you know, things that I had never raised. For example, you know, your human rights, which obviously, we, as we know, are qualifiable, whereas we were talking about inalienable rights, you know, the your God-given natural rights that a constitution and laws only describe. They're rights that we have because of our human dignity. So after a while, I just stopped trying to argue with them because there's no point. I just read to them. I'm proud and happy to have done what I did. And, you know,
I think they scored an own goal with you in particular, because you, having decided that, you know, you'd worked hard for years, you have grandchildren, you're still a young woman, but you've done enough. And, you know, you not being dependent on it went against them, went against them. And then by doing what they did, they gave an incredible amount of publicity to you, because the Irish press covered it, the press in the UK covered it, the press in the north covered it. And all it does, really, because I came across you, you see, I see this photograph of this, you know, kind looking lady. And I'm like, oh, what's this all about? And you go in and you read it. And then you learn that practiced medicine for years, very well liked in the community. Why is this lady saying what she's saying? And I think you would have saved a lot of people, I think. And by them making it public as they did and doing what they did, they drew attention to you. And I think that would have saved a lot of people. What do you... this? I know it's anecdotal, but we do have the yellow card reporting system. By the way, folks, you're listening to Dr. Anne McCloskey, a much respected and much admired GP. Will always be Dr. Anne McCloskey, whatever the General Medical Council says, and politician. And we'll talk about moves that Anne is making at the moment. We'll talk about that shortly as well. But In terms of what we know about injuries, so what are we now? We're March 2024. How widespread do you think are COVID vaccine injuries? How widespread and how much damage has been done and is being done? If we say that it is happening and it's terrible, how is the media getting away with not reporting on it in the face of, you know, mounting evidence that these jabs are doing so much, causing so much pain and causing so much loss of life and so much injury? How bad is it, do you think?
Well, what I do know is the doctors and the politicians are baffled at this amazing increase in all-cause mortality and worse in younger age groups. Richie, this could be solved tomorrow. If the Office of National Statistics and the Northern Ireland Statistics and Research Agency and all of these publicly funded bodies who are supposed to keep us safe, if they would publish deaths and morbidity and hospital admissions and mortalities as a function of vaccination status, and they will not do it. They will not do it because they know what's going to be revealed. So instead, they're saying it's climate change, it's what are you talking about, it's not statins, even though the prescription numbers of statins didn't go down. I mean, it's everything. And then the long COVID. And I mean, we knew this, that vaccine injuries were going to be called, you know, COVID or, you know, some other iteration of
Anne, can you explain this a bit better for me? Because I understand that when somebody has a particularly bad flu or some other winter virus, that it can, after they come out of the worst of it, it can leave them feeling pretty low and energyless and tired for quite a considerable time afterwards. So when I've talked about this on this programme, people who would disagree with me, they would say, don't laugh at long COVID, Richie. You know, post-viral syndromes and fatigues, these are things that we've known about for a long time. So what would you say to them?
Well, in my 40 years of clinical experience, I found they were quite unusual, you know, to last longer than a couple of days. You know, you feel rubbish for maybe a week or two after a bad dose. And I don't speak from personal experience here. Normally it's 3 or 4 days and you're bouncing back again. Lemsip and hot whiskey seems to work reasonably
and
well.
And the cloves and the lemons, yeah.
Do you know, that's all COVID was. I no longer believe that there was anything. It was a rebranding of whatever happens to people in the winter, and added with a liberal use of end-of-life pathways in the care homes. That's what COVID was.
Now, hang on. Forgive me for interrupting again. And we have as much time as you want now until 6 o'clock, right? When you get tired of it, you can go and leave me sitting here. I don't mind. But I always give my guests plenty of time to speak. But I've got to pick you up on this. I'm very open-minded about this. I haven't a clue. I have no medical training, no scientific training. So I have to defer to your expertise. But why do you think COVID itself didn't exist? We hear about lab leaks in China and, you know, some scientists have said that they have seen it under a microscope and other people say those scientists are telling lies. No. Why are you so convinced that COVID-19 was an invention? Why?
In the winter, the mortality rate goes up. COVID, certainly, we'll put COVID in inverted commas, but whatever that was the same. It was the same mortality as happened every winter. Whatever it was, it tended to take with it the old, the infirm, people with multiple comorbidities, people who were in end of life care in any case, people with cancer. It didn't affect young people, it didn't affect healthy people. There was no signal. In no country across this beautiful planet was there an increase in age-standardized all-cause mortality during the months that were supposedly this deathly pandemic that plagued the world. And I've written, I had an article published in the British Medical Journal arguing exactly this. They had a front cover page about 100,000 deaths. No. If you had a positive PCR test within 28 days, of your demise. And people, don't forget, we're getting, these tests had a significant false positive rate, and people were getting tested every day in the hospital, sometimes twice a day.
They were,
Once they got a positive test, then they were then they were a COVID case. And if they got run over by a steamroller, you know, a friend of mine who's a nurse, this is a story that will give you an idea of the sorts of things that were going on. A friend of mine who's a nurse told me, she rang me up and she was distraught. She said, Anne, my senior, the nurse, the manager, asked me to go and do a PCR test on the dead remains, the dead body of a woman who had hung herself with her dressing gown cord in her own room. She came to hospital. She was dead at the time of admission. And my friend, the nurse, was asked to go, and she refused. She said, no, I'm not doing that. Why would I?
Why would you do that? Unless you're trying to bump up the numbers. That's the only conclusion I could draw.
This is what happened. That's why they were tested, you know, 12 hourly, and people who went in with completely unrelated things then were moved into the, in inverted commas, COVID wards, all of that. In terms of mortality, the flu went off. The flu didn't happen. COVID did. Now, I don't think we need to have the conversation about do viruses exist or not. Certainly, the science of virology is required for the pharmaceutical interventions known as vaccines. Those two things are very much a Siamese twin. They're mutually interdependent. And certainly, I've read things on both sides. I don't think, as I say, what you can say is statistically, nothing happened. Nothing untoward happened anywhere in the world.
Nothing unusual, you mean? Sorry,
Anne. COVID cases.
Sorry.
What virus respects national borders?
Yeah.
You know? And in New York, there were, was it three hospitals? You know, were the only places where there was this huge spike in mortality.
I've looked at all of this stuff inside out, you know, with my kind of commercial media background. And funnily enough, it's funny you went to the no virus thing. Look, I wouldn't have brought that up. And the reason, some of my listeners, they fall out with me from time to time. And it's only because I'm fairly... Well, listen, I'm consistent, right? I'm consistent. I don't understand why viruses... I don't understand why terrain theory... and germ theory can't coexist. I don't understand why they can't coexist. So I'm open to the idea that viruses do exist. And that annoys some listeners because I'm supposed to be on board with all of the nothing happened or nothing existed. Look, I'm fascinated by you. I'm very interested in what you're saying about COVID itself not existing. And I'm open to this because I'm not a fool, Anne. And they told me last year or the year before, this old gammony, baldy journalist who, you know, I'm a bit cynical. They told me that, well, flu disappeared because of social distancing. Give me a break. I'm not that stupid. Please don't say that to me. I deserve better than you telling me that. So what you're saying makes some sort of sense to me. You know, that COVID itself didn't exist, that they decided to rebrand the flu. But here's the thing, and I'm not asking you to answer this because you will not have an answer for it, because I don't have an answer for it. How can they get away with that without somebody blowing the bloody whistle? I mean, you're asking people all over the world to be involved in, let's pretend that the normal seasonal illnesses are this new thing called COVID and we have to turn the world upside down in order to deal with it. How can they bloody well get away with that? I rack my brains, and I think it's possible, and by the way, I think it's possible, but I think, how could they pull it off, you know?
Yeah.
And they did.
Well, this is the most detailed and planned psychological operation which has ever been perpetrated in the human race. I mean, in Britain, in the Ministry of Defence, you had an entire 77 Brigade of the British Army putting out... you know, fear porn, propaganda. Yeah. You had billions of pounds spent on messaging, on, you know, walk, don't walk signage, you know, black and yellow things. That's the colour of a bee. Apparently it triggers something. Then
Radiation. It's radiation, isn't it? It's radiation. Yeah. This occurred to me when I saw the black and yellow signs. I thought, that's associated with watching films about radioactivity and stuff. Yeah.
It's danger, yeah. And but apparently they know that those colours in nature exist too. They trigger something deep in you. The them as recesses of your brain. I don't know enough about it, but this was this, and this was planned meticulously. And in countries where they didn't believe in it and where there was no real, you know, strong media presence, it didn't happen. You had, wasn't it Haiti? And you know, the island where the half got it and half didn't. You know, it respects national borders. And if you looked right at the very beginning, I told Derry and Strabane District Council that there was no need to cancel the St. Patrick's Day parade in 2020. They did anyway. But at that stage, the data was in. We had the Diamond Princess. We had Professor Levitt's stuff. We had Johnny and Edith's stuff. You know, we knew that this was a in terms of mortality, a non-significant, you know, thing that was not going to affect the vast majority of people. And yet, even with that knowledge, they went ahead and locked down because it was about getting fear and ramping up all of that to make people psychologically prepared to roll up their sleeves and have a toxin injected into them. Now, that, if that makes me a conspiracy theorist, so be it. I have absolutely no doubt the evidence is clear that that was the pretext. It was about vaccination from day dot. It was about getting these mRNA technologies, maybe just to make, I mean, tens of billions of pounds for the pharmaceutical industries. And don't forget, what happens is pharmaceutical industries fund the universities. The universities produce the bullshit science, which then completes the circle, and everybody gets paid, everybody gets happy. The standard of scientific analysis of this has been utterly pathetic. And people then, you know, I mean, for example, when I spoke out, I was immediately censored. That isn't about me. Nobody really cares what an old woman in Derry and in Ireland is saying, but it is about the tens of thousands of other doctors who would say, who are saying the same thing as I saw.
Of course, it's a warning. Them. It's a warning. And look, it was. I know you haven't. I know you've never made it about you. It's one of the reasons I like you. I do genuinely like you because you've never made it about you and, you know, celebrity or any of that nonsense. You've been a GP for 40 years. Look, before you first came on, I kind of turned you upside down to see if there was anything in your past, you know, anything that maybe would be something I could maybe have a go at you for, and I couldn't find anything other than unblemished record, everybody likes you. So it was about shutting you up because you are, as I said earlier, a kind, you know, very reasonable, respectable woman with all of that experience. We don't want people hearing what she has to say. But you're right, it was also to send a message out to every other doctor. This is what happens when you step outside the line. Dr. Anne McCluskey is our guest. There's lots more that people want to ask you about this issue and other issues. If I don't ask you this, and this is going to sound like a crazy segue, but it isn't. I think you've made your position clear on the jabs and why they did it and the injuries. Were you heartened in any way last Friday week when the people of Ireland said no to two referendums that were frankly ridiculous and completely unnecessary to change the wording of the Irish Constitution around mothers and around what constitutes a family? Was that simply a bloody nose to the government, or was it a sign of something even more positive than that? How did you take it?
Funny, I was beforehand. I was commenting on a Substack and saying I think this is going to be a plebiscite on satisfaction in general with this government. And I kind of called it. I said there's going to be, you know, for a referendum, you know, the 50% turnout is pretty good. Donegal, the county next to me, Donegal, the pride of all, Donegal and Derry, Derry's the capital of Donegal, so that they had 80% telling the government to go and get lost. This government are a government of occupation. You see, the thing that people really need to understand is we live, these emergency powers are martial law. We live in a military dictatorship. Our governments of occupation, and I'm talking about Britain and Scotland and Wales and Ireland, these people are not serving the people who elected them. They're serving globalist masters, and they, you know, the courts are military tribunals, the military courts, and we need to seek we need to change our status and seek protection on the Geneva Convention, because this is, we live in very, I'm not trying to frighten people or whatever, but you need to understand what is happening. The referendum, I think, was I think it's a sign, because what's happened, Ireland is the country which has, over the last 2 decades, 25 years maybe, Ireland is unrecognizable from what it was. We're the only country in Europe who never invaded anybody, who never exploited anybody else's resources. We suffered, you know, 1,100 years of we were the first and last of the British imperial project, and we ostensibly got 26 counties wrested from that, just over 100 years ago. So we had, 50 or 60 years of relative calm, and you know, the famine, the genocide that happened against this country. And now we're being called racist because we don't want 1.6 billion Africans. Are we going to take them all? Like, you know, and again, there's no issue with people coming who want to contribute, who want to speak English, you know, assimilate themselves into our societies. But busloads of young men who are laughing as they're burning their passports, arriving into villages in rural Ireland in the middle of the night, it's insane.
And by the way, sorry to interrupt you, people will be expecting me to challenge this because I get criticised if I don't challenge.
Sure.
I'm not going to challenge. By the government's own admission, 80% or more arrive with no documentation whatsoever. That's a problem. Sure. So Anne is right to say this because bang on the money. And can I just say this? How difficult is this? I mean, I can hear the anger in your voice. One of the things I'm most proud of about Ireland is that we're an incredibly generous people. And whenever there was an appeal throughout my lifetime for anything, for a disaster, whether it was an earthquake, whether it was a famine, the Irish were the first, or they were amongst the first anyway, to say, right, put our money, we'll put our hands into our pockets, we'll do what we can, we'll take as many people as we can, we'll send the best of our own people overseas to help with all of this. So how galling is it then, you know, when you point out the madness of Ireland's migration policy, to be called some sort of far-right thug for just asking questions? It must grate on you and everybody else there.
Absolutely shocking. And we see the vilification of people who live in working class communities where they have all the properties of all the problems of drug addiction and homelessness and all of that. And these are the people who are bearing the brunt of this, not the people who live in the leafy suburbs, and certainly not the politicians. And whenever they're saying no, you know, this is not happening, and take to the streets and protest, they're called by the very people who are organizing this, that, you know, that they're far right and racist and all this utter and complete nonsense. These are good people who are worried about their families, worried about their own safety, worried about their schools, worried about healthcare provision, and don't want to see people who have set fire to their passport in Dublin Airport getting housed and getting, you know, immediate dental care, health care and all the rest, while ordinary the people of Ireland are being, you know, just absolutely ignored, and their problems being, you know, made worse, if you like, by a government that is completely divorced from, you know, the ordinary people's concerns. It's an absolute scandal. And of course, again, you know, the thing is that with the COVID thing, it was, you had to do it for other people. Nobody's safe until we're all safe. You know, you've got to protect your granny and all of that. And this is the same. It appeals to people's kindness, their generosity, their intrinsic love of their fellow man. And it uses that against them, you know, to make them feel guilty for not saying, you know, I mean, this wee island cannot house everybody who is in a war zone or is in you know, it lives in a country where they're financially worse off than they would be here. You know, we had a government minister tweeting in 7 languages, come, bring your families, come, Ireland is open. And this, as you're probably aware, is part of the the whole United Nations Agenda 2030 campaign, where you break down nation states, you break down national identity, you break down any feeling of pride and cohesion that people have, their cultural values, their religious values, you get rid of all that. And this is one of the tools that it's done. And the people who are coming here, they're being used.
Of course, yeah.
Style game yeah. also. Everybody suffers, including the countries that they leave. What happens is the British Empire and the Wall Street and the City of London finance and create wars all over the world and impoverish people and steal their natural resources and then, you know, ship them off, you know, as problems instead of suing for peace and looking for ways of improving people's standard of living where they live. You know, this is what is required, but it's not what's happening.
I think
every
you nailed it, I think you nailed it. I think because of what they want to bring in, because of the world they want to build, they feel the best way to offset any opposition is to do what they're doing with the migrant flows. They create the conditions in countries to set the migrant flow in motion, believing that yeah. there's less likely to be cohesion than within individual countries against Agenda 2030. Because if you do to Ireland what they're doing to Ireland now, their hope is that we'll turn on the migrants. And of course, Irish people will never turn on the migrants. Irish people will, please God, continue to turn on the government. But that's what they want. Yeah. They want that yeah. identity politics, that culture war, and then people don't look at the architect. Who's the, what's really going on? And I suppose that's what you're doing these days now, isn't it? Is trying to alert people to why this is happening, because that's the most important thing. Of course, it's affecting people's ability to get a good job, to get medical care, good education. And these are things that must be protested against. But you're right to do what you're doing, to say, well, look, there's a bigger picture. What's the bigger picture? Do you have much success with that, Anne? You know, trying to explain to people why it's happening, you know?
I think certainly in working class communities, I mean, the referendum, I think, was in a way a sort of a guideline to the way that people are actually realising what's happening. You know, I'm hopeful that certainly in grassroots movements, not in the chattering classes, but the people. Real people, the people who actually drive this country and who work in it, are very, very well informed. I mean, we saw the attempts by the Gardaí and by the forces of the state to drum up, riots and to create situations that would arise that would lead to conflict. And I have to say that the natives showed remarkable restraint and considerable understanding of the dynamics and refused to be drawn into that. And, the riots in Dublin, I think, were largely manufactured and it was just, you know, looters, gurriers. The police inexplicably left all the doors of their police car open and then went away and left it. You know, the thing was obviously designed to, you know, entice people to commit crimes, and they didn't. They stepped back and showed, and again, some of the local leaders. I mean, these people are to be commended. It's huge admiration for them. Yeah,
Dr. Anne.
Interestingly,
go ahead, Anne.
The woman and the children, the mammies with the prams. You know, are making the videos in their standing in their street corners and talking about the issues that they face. It's very, very powerful.
Yeah, but if you listen to RTE, those mammies they're Nazis, Anne. You know, you got to give them a wide berth. You know, mammies. It's laughable, isn't it? Don't talk about RTE. Dr. Anne McCloskey is our guest. Before I ask, before I ask you about getting back into politics, which is where we'll finish up, I think, for today. We'll talk about the politics thing. Let me read a few kind and lovely messages that have come in. This is the live radio show. People send in messages via the Richie Allen Show app and via the website. They're coming in. Tell your lovely, intelligent, well-spoken guest tonight that she is most definitely not a grumpy old lady. Anyone who's been around a while can see that commercialism has taken over every religious occasion, Christmas, Easter, St. Patrick's Day, etc., to the point that the reason the day is special has become unimportant to a large majority of people. Well done, Anne, and that's from Tricia. Thank you for that. This one from Frank with a C. Frank, love you, Doctor. Thanks for your truth and for your wisdom and for your advice. That's from Frank. Thank you for that, Frank. Must be French with that name. Kay says, I love listening to Anne, a retired woman like me. We can speak out. Us retired women, we have nothing to lose. Accountable to nobody. Speak out, all you ladies of a certain age. Let's save our children and grandchildren. That's from Kay. Thank you, Kay. Kieran is a fellow Derry citizen. I heard, listened to and understood and believed Anne from the beginning. She certainly helped me in seeing through the fiasco. I can go on and on and on. There's so many of these coming through. Good evening to Elizabeth, who says, in the Netherlands, they established public-funded long COVID treatment clinics where people get free medical treatment. So the established long COVID treatment clinics, they're doing this here in the UK as well. A jab-injured whistleblower has stated that in her support network of other injured people, many have given up getting treatment for the jab injury and have turned to these clinics because otherwise they would get no help at all. That's a brilliant point, that. That's a really interesting point from Elizabeth there. And let me read one or two more and then we're going to ask Anne about politics. Good evening to Christine. Christine asks, Richie, would you ask Anne if it is true that Robin Swan lost the vote to keep the emergency powers in Northern Ireland a couple of weeks ago? A brilliant woman, says Christine. Did Robin Swan lose a vote to keep emergency powers in Northern Ireland, or does it go back to London? I think Christine is asking.
The health part only, the emergency powers with regard to the health mandates and the, you know, the COVID regulations and that. He lost that vote, yes. But I mean, the Department of Justice, Department of Finance, all the other departments are still under emergency powers, which, as I've said, is actually martial law. This is a, you know, this is we essentially don't have rights anymore, and it's important that people realise this. Hence, you know.
No, before, because I want to ask then, let's say we'll do 10 more minutes then, because I know you have other things to do as well. So we'll do 10 more minutes on why you're going back into politics. But you're obviously concerned about the plans to give pandemic planning powers exclusively to the World Health Organization. This would be disastrous, wouldn't it?
Without a doubt, this is the most terrifying piece of legislation I've ever seen. So that it is, you know, even if it is the opinion of a man who's not a doctor, who was a communist terrorist in his former life, that there's a pandemic in the offing, that the recommendation can be, you know, whatever measures are decided by the World Health Organization. And this organization is utterly in the pocket of international corporations, particularly the pharmaceutical industry, and it's horrifying. Anybody who wants to look into it, James Rogowski has a wonderful
Substack. Yeah, he's very good. He's very good.
In amazing detail, he's tireless, and most people don't even know who their representatives on the national representatives on the World Health Organization are, and. It's completely unaccountable and it's completely corrupt. Completely corrupt. So, the politics, my politics are very simple. Out of the United Nations, out of the World Health Organization, out of the European Union, start building resilient communities, build from the ground up, support farmers, a new education system, you know, outside of the one that exists. We need to take the power back into families, communities. And it's not going to be easy, you know. None of this is going to be easy. But I can't see any solution within the current framework. So Yeah.
So you, before I ask you why, and you can share with our listeners where you will be standing and what people need to know about that. Anne is on Twitter, of course, at Dr. Anne. There is an E in Anne, of course, Dr. Anne Derry on Twitter. But do follow Anne on Facebook as well. She's a huge following on Facebook and is regularly posting there. And on Facebook, it is D-R Anne. For the number four, Derry. So D or Anne for Derry on Facebook. Give Anne a follow. So you want to disrupt then. I like the sounds of it. So where and when will you be standing and where can people find out more about it?
Yeah. Well, as I say, the last thing I wanted to do at my stage in life, I actually thought, Richie, after working as a doctor for 40 years, I'd be playing golf relax. In the Riviera. It didn't work out that way. I thought, you know, you get peace and you'll be able to enjoy the park with your grandchildren and winter out somewhere nice and sunny. And didn't happen. So after I retired, I went into local politics. And again, it was largely because of the change in the abortion laws in the north and campaigned and canvassed very hard, both north and south. You know, to try and protect the right to life of the unborn child. So I joined them, a political party called AIN2. Now, I don't speak ill of AIN2 because I don't want to do that. But whenever I was, there's a beautiful book, a pamphlet written by a philosopher called Simone Weil, and I think it was the 1940s, and it was called On the Abolition of All Political Parties. And she makes a very intelligent case that political parties inherently lead to corruption and nepotism, and everybody starts off an idealist, and then, you know, the thing gets a life of its own, and particularly as you become more powerful and influential, the whole thing goes tits up, and I think that certainly that seems to me to make sense. So I'm an advocate of an independent model. I don't think this can be fixed in any of the national parliaments, none of it, because they're all they're completely
The uni party. It's the uni party system we live under, isn't it? Yeah.
But the only reason. So as I say, whenever I started to speak out as a member of a political party, the establishment in that party freaked because, you know, it takes a certain amount of courage to go against the narrative at that very early stage, and for a political party that was just formed, I mean, I get it. It was a nightmare, and they had this mousy doctor who was their deputy leader on the island, and the leader in the north, saying things that were very, shall we say, counter narrative. So I resigned, and I have never spoke ill of them.
No, you've never said a bad word about him, which is to your absolute credit.
I don't think that's useful, but, you know, and as I say, my council seat was given to somebody who said, who openly and publicly dissed what I had said in that same seat, which I won. Anyway, all of that. So I never intend to go back to politics, but I think it is true that we need a capacity for people to show their disgust at the way they've been treated for the last 3 or 4 years, particularly in the 26 counties. Ireland has been absolutely hijacked.
Captured, yeah.
Civilized nation, by a shower of... It's difficult to find a word that is allowed to be said in radio.
You can say what you want here, by the way. This is absolutely... You can say any... I'm not trying to encourage you to swear, but you can say whatever you want.
I mean, these people are utterly devoid of any semblance of morality.
And humanity, it's gone.
And humanity, they detest the Irish people. Once you understand that, they detest this country, they detest the people who live in it, they detest our way of life, our cultural values. They detest us, you know, collectively and individually. And once you realise that, so, you know, if somebody goes into the election now in the 26 counties, which is coming up, I think, in May, they have Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, Sinn Féin. I think there still is their PD. I don't follow politics very closely. People Before Profit, the Greens. Who in the name of God can you vote for? You know, there is no least bad option. They're all putrid, Totally.
Fully on board with the climate change lie. Totally. Fully on board with jabbing the bejesus out of everybody to kingdom come. And fully on board with most of them, fully on board with membership of the European Union, which has been nothing but a disaster for Ireland. Yes. Absolutely.
And fuller integration and globalism and, you know, the whatever sort of corporate fascism they're planning. People think that, you know, it's cultural Marxism. They think communism's a good idea. They think they're going to keep the stuff they have and get the rich people's stuff too. No, they're not. But they want it. This is going to be a reversion to feudalism. This is going to be communism for the masses, feudalism for us, and for the people who own. You know, it's extreme corporate capitalism for the fraction of 1% who essentially will control us, and the depopulation agenda. All of that is proceeding apace. So people need at least a choice. In the ballot box, that's all they can do is protest. And as I say, I'm not under any illusion. So there's a few organisations in Ireland, and I don't want to name them because I'm going to leave somebody out, you know, but there's people who have been on the right side of this from the start. Where that, this organisation that I'm a part of is called, it's the Irish People. So there are, where there is an alternative, viable alternative, the candidate, we don't need to stand anybody, but where there is no choice for people, then they're really wanting bums and seats that people will say, yes, I'll put my name down. If you look at what happened in the by-election in England, Gorgeous George got...
McGalloway, yeah.
But a complete unknown fellow who'd never spoken publicly anywhere. He was, I think, he run a car repair business or something like that? Got nearly 30%.
Yeah.
Because people heard what... Just... None of the above is what people want to vote for, because they see that these uni parties give no protection to them whatsoever, and that their rights are for sale to the highest bidder. So that's essentially what's happening.
That's what you're doing.
And I said no, and about 15 times I said no, and then I was met at, did a Zoom call with an amazing individual called AJ Cahill, a Galway man who I'd never met before. Spoke to him for an hour. He was completely persuasive and sane, and I just thought, yeah, again, I don't want to do this, but somebody has to. And you know, for people, some people it'd be very frightening to say, God, I couldn't do that. I can't speak. You know, I wouldn't know what to say. You know, so I can. I don't have any idea of whether I'll get 5 votes or 5,000 votes. I have no clue. It's a constituency which is just over the border. It's Lifford, Stranorlar, it's County Donegal. You know, Derry is, as you know, the border goes out around the city of Derry.
That's right.
To take Derry into the north, in inverted commas, and Donegal then is you know, Derry's. So it is. It, I mean, where I worked in Chantelle Health Centre was, you know, a 3-minute drive to the border. So yeah, that's my latest project. So it looks like that
it's going to take up most of your time, man. Listen, thanks for coming back. I'm going to put links to where the Facebook and Twitter where people can find out more about what you're going to be doing in the coming months. So I'll definitely do that. Don't be a stranger. If you fancy a good rant or a good kickoff, I'm always here between 4 and 6, Monday to Thursday.
I follow your stuff as well as I can. You know, I do listen in, but it's just so much good quality stuff. It's wonderful. Great. So congratulations to you and all that you're doing.
You're very kind, Anne. Thanks. And you're right. There is so much good quality out there. There is. We should talk it up more often. And I should talk it up more often. Good luck, as I said, in the travails and the travels in the next few weeks and months. And so we'll even talk closer to the time about it.
Yeah.
And I really enjoyed hearing you again today. Thanks for your time today. And
no bother. And your listeners are very kind. They're a bit too kind. But anyway, it was nice to hear that people kind of are finding some of what I say resonates with them. So it's all good.
Brilliant.
So lovely to be on, Richard. And all the best. God bless.
Sláinte, Tom. Bye-bye. And Anne. Bye for now. Dr. Anne McCluskey, live on the line from Derry. It's 18 minutes to the top of the hour. I will put links to Anne's Facebook and Twitter on the podcast notes. Do get on there, follow Anne there, say hello to her there. She's great at interacting with people and speaking to them on social media, so do that. And find out more about what she's going to be doing in Derry and in Donegal in the next few weeks, Dr. Anne McCluskey. I'll read your messages, because lots of messages, and thank you for them. I want to talk about something I said earlier on, because I don't want any confusion about something I said before I spoke with Anne.
The Richie Allen Show relies on your support. Visit richieallen.co.uk and make a financial contribution today.
Right, do support whatever independent media you're listening to and watching and reading all the time, because it's the only way we have of surviving, of doing what it is we're doing. Good evening to Tim. Whatever the future holds, thank the Lord there's those like Anne out there acting on our behalf, he says. Glenn says, I live in Dr. Anne's area, he says. I believe she should stick to being a doctor, says Glenn. She hasn't a hope in hell of being elected, says Glenn. Tell us what you really think, Glenn. I think she's great. I think she has a lot to say. I think she should be heard. Seamus says, Richie, isn't the role of mother the cornerstone of the family? The recent attempt to change the legislation was to undermine this in a nation that has been traditionally built around the idea of the clan. Recent immigration seems designed to stress that fundamental virtue. I wonder what the figures are on single persons coming into Ireland as against those arriving registered as a family unit. Steve says, when I fell ill with supposed COVID-19 in 2021, the 5G signal in my area had been activated a few months earlier. I was in hospital for 16 days as it attacked my lungs, and I was forced to have a fake PCR test, he says. Hi to Gillian, who says, I absolutely love Dr. Anne. Please have her back more often, Richie, and I wish her all the very best in the forthcoming election. Thanks for that, Gillian. And let me scroll down. I don't want to leave any of these out. I'm going to the website now. Donald says, regarding what happened in Dublin on November 23rd, the riots, Garda vehicles, he says, were not locked. Allegedly. Is that what you're saying to me? Of which were set on fire by throwing in on fire cardboard boxes. Donald, you need to write that out again. And post it again. It doesn't make an awful lot of sense to me. Yes, you've no excuse when you post one to the website. It's a little bit more difficult when you send through the app. But do double check what it is you're about to send before you send it. Anne says, Krista Gardner says, Anne makes a good point. A lot of people believed they were doing the right thing and regarded unmasked, unjabbed fools as dangerous, says Chris. Anne made a good point about that. Thank you to Chris for that. Now, on something I said earlier on. Working at WLRFM in Ireland, later on, very briefly, doing a little bit of BBC regional stuff, later on, working for Talk Radio Europe in Spain, I went out of my way to interview the members, family members of those who were killed at Hillsborough. I was in a very bad way in Waterford Regional Hospital with pneumonia. I was 15, and I watched the events of Hillsborough unfold live on RTE television, which was covering the semi-final of the FA Cup match between Liverpool and Nottingham Forest. It was horrendous to watch it. Horrendous. There was no censorship then. These days, the cameras would pull away and they would not show what was happening. In those days, they showed you exactly what was happening. 96 Liverpool fans were killed. It was completely the fault of the police in charge of controlling the match on the day. Completely the fault of the police. And it was covered up on the day by local MPs, by the police, and ultimately by the ruling Conservative Party. Margaret Thatcher's government covered it up. Kelvin McKenzie in The Sun and The Sun newspaper did the most disgusting thing, one of the most disgusting things that was ever done by a national newspaper. They published barefaced lies, disgusting lies about the Liverpool fans, saying that the Liverpool fans had interfered with the emergency services tending to the grievously wounded. And they made up some horrible stories about pickpocketing and about urination and all of this shit. It was nonsense. There was no blame whatsoever. Liverpool fans. And I spent years interviewing mums of lads who died on the day and other campaigners and politicians in Liverpool. It's despicable what happened. And I mean that. And people who have known me for years will remember me broadcasting about this. However, it cannot be allowed that a few dickheads who sing songs about what happened at Hillsborough can be arrested and charged with a crime by the police in this country. That is, it's beyond a slippery slope. I'm talking about the fact that after the United Liverpool FA Cup quarter final yesterday, a number of United fans were arrested for what the police call tragedy chanting. And this has become a thing now, tragedy chanting, whereby somebody says something or sings something and they can pick out two or three people. In fairness, it would have been hundreds of people doing it. No doubt about that. I've been a United fan my entire life. I was at the game yesterday. I was behind the goal opposite the Stretford end at the East Stand. I was under and alongside Liverpool fans. And when Liverpool fans began to sing a chant that they sing quite often, which is pretty boring, to be honest. I mean, let's be honest about it. Liverpool, Liverpool. It goes on like this, you see. It's pretty boring. We've got boring chants too. United fans were singing Murderers. This is against the law now, apparently, in this country. Now, I wasn't singing Murderers. I don't like it. I was at United against Liverpool in the league last year. United played them at home, game three into the season. I was in the same stand, and a couple of guys alongside me started shouting Murderers. I'm no virtue signaler. It pissed me off, and I told them to sit the fuck down and shut up. I said, they're not murderers at all. Whatever they might be, they're not murderers. And they were younger lads. They sat down, they shut up. It is unbelievable that the police can arrest people for singing songs or saying things. And nobody should be in favour of it. I see some Liverpool fans online today, some of them well-known fans, applauding this, the arrest of men for simply saying or shouting hearty words. I like to think that after everything the families of those who died at Hillsborough went through, that a few morons at a game of football are completely incapable of hurting these people. How could it be that the families of those who died in 1989 could be injured somehow by a couple of pissed up fucking idiot football fans? It's tyranny is what it is. And it goes for any fan who might sing songs about the disaster at Ibrox where 66 people were killed, or Bradford where the stadium, a stand caught on fire and dozens of people were killed. You know, how it could be a thing that somebody could be arrested for it. I remember last year, or maybe the year before, there was a beautiful young boy who was a fan of Sunderland. I think his name was Bradley. Bradley Lowry. Bradley Lowry, that's right. Bradley Lowry. This beautiful young boy. And he became friends with Jermaine Defoe, I believe. And this young lad had this incredibly rare form of cancer. And there was no hope for him. A beautiful kid, as I said, and he eventually passed away. And a year or so later, Sunderland were at home, and one of the opposition fans who travelled to Sunderland held a photograph of the kid up, pointed at it and laughed, and he was arrested and charged. You can be arrested now in this country and charged and convicted and sent to prison for being a fucking idiot. And we're in a very, very, very bad place if idiots can be arrested, charged, tried, and then given a custodial sentence. It's madness. It's utter madness. You know, and you see this identity politics. You see, you know, people playing off against one another online. People applauding when the supporter of a team they don't like is arrested and charged and tried and convicted. It's madness. And that's what I meant earlier on. So I've had a few messages from Liverpool fans who said, I thought better of you, Richie. What do you mean you thought better of me? It's ridiculous. Ridiculous. That they could be arrested and given a banning order for singing a song, for God's sake. It's madness. Anyway, rant over. Rant over. Hi to Ambrose. Richie, he says, a little bit off topic, But when you look at the ethnic makeup of the Commons and the Lords, it seems like the English government is still using their colonies to do their dirty work, says Ambrose, who's in Rhodes in Greece, listening to this. Ambrose, yeah. I mean, yeah. Why not? It is funny, isn't it? They talk about racism and Britain is a racist country and it's institutionally racist. And yet you look at the current Prime Minister, you look at the Mayor of London, you look at the First Minister of Scotland, you look at the new First Minister of Wales, this Vaughan Gething. Wasn't he a complete scumbag during COVID, wasn't he? He was Wales's health minister, an evil, horrible little man. He was very much like Nicola Sturgeon, gleefully talking about lockdowns and restrictions, Vaughan Gething. So look at the fucking state of it. And then you look at the Republic of Ireland. You look at the Taoiseach of Ireland. I believe, and I have no proof of this, is that when they put ethnic minorities front and centre in all of their governments, not just the leaders, but the other big offices of state, right, you know, crime, justice, Home Secretary, all of that, when you see it, they're laughing in people's faces. They're basically gaslighting you. You know, telling you on the one hand that you are part of a majority of people, you are racist, you are bigoted, you are homophobic, you are misogynistic. They're laughing at you. That's all they're doing. Morning, noon and night, they're laughing at people. No doubt about it. Thank you for that, Ambrose. Isabella has been in touch. What an honour to have heard. Anne, says Isabella, Mark Windows would be proud of her doing exactly what he believes, which is run in local elections to try and make a difference in your locality, to be a spanner in the works. Thank you. Julie says, I love Anne, been following her for years. I'm glad to hear her today. And thank you, Lucy from Northern Ireland. She says, Richie, thank heavens for Dr. Anne McCluskey. Excellent guest, says Lucy. Screech says, I'm a Liverpool fan, Richie. Some people can't help but shout nonsense at football games, but it's not criminal. Exactly, Screech. And you know, one of the payoffs is what they really want to do is disempower people. It is disempowering people, whether it's the families of those who were killed at Hillsborough, wrongfully killed, wrongfully murdered by the inadequacy and the ineptitude of the police and then the cover-up by the government. But they're disempowering people. They're telling people, well, you're vulnerable and you're helpless. You know, you're not strong enough and you're not intelligent enough to know to ignore a few fools at a football match. Therefore, we're going to disempower you, take that power away from you and prosecute these people. That's what it is. It's the constant creation of vulnerable groups all over the world that need to be protected by Big Brother. I mean, again, it is galling, not because it's Man United. I said this last year. I said it the year before when fans of other football clubs were arrested. It is madness and dangerous enough of the rant. Rob says, Richie, you're right. It's 100% slippery slope. When will it end, says Rob. Thank you, Rob. There endeth the programme today. Thank you so much to Dr. Anne McCloskey. Really appreciate Anne. Thank you for listening. The Richie Allen Show will return tomorrow at the same time, 4 o'clock UK time. Before that, I will be with you via the papers thing, the podcast. It will be online early tomorrow morning. Enjoy the rest of your Monday. Thanks for listening. And I played that earlier, didn't I? What's wrong with me? Have I even drug out a song? No, I haven't. I've been too busy ranting. Right, closing out with this. Bye. Mike and the Mechanic. See you tomorrow. Bye now.